And now, the best of health and fitness, the show that covers the health and fitness topics that matter most. Here's your host, Shani Rubin.
Welcome, listeners, to the best of health and fitness. I am your host, Shani Rubin. Today, we will be discussing ADHD with nationally recognized disability community leader and motivational speaker, Mr. Robert Todisco. He is also an adult diagnosed with ADHD, along with a dedicated voice in the courtroom as a practicing attorney. Let me give a warm welcome to Mr. Robert Todisco. Good morning, Robert. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm great.
Good. Okay. So you know what? Let's jump right into it. Let's start a little bit by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, like you said, I'm a practicing attorney. I always knew that I was very different, but I was undiagnosed for most of my life. I was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult at a very kind of difficult time in my life. And it really forced me to go back and look at what was happening and why I struggled so much as a kid in school and why I had so much difficulty. And it really led me to change the direction of my practice. I was a former prosecutor, and I've been a defense attorney for 25 years. And after my own diagnosis and seeing a lot of patterns developing in the adolescents that I was representing in criminal court, it occurred to me that I was kind of seeing them a little differently because of the information I had about my own diagnosis and other people with different mental health disorders. And so it led me to change the direction of my practice, because it's very frustrating when you're a criminal defense attorney. You get the call too late. Someone's done something horribly wrong. But if I was working with parents to get support and services for kids at a much younger age on the educational side, I might not be getting as many crisis calls later on in their lives. And so I started to open up my practice, and now my particular niche is I represent families getting services for their students with disabilities. And unfortunately, right now in our culture, a lot more kids are getting disciplined at school and arrested for the same conduct. And so I am able to actually represent these kids in the criminal part of the case, as well as the administrative process that goes along with school discipline. And it all came about really because of my own diagnosis and my understanding how I think and process information. So I really understand my clients a lot better because of that.
Sure, you can relate to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What age were you diagnosed?
I was 34 when I was diagnosed, and interestingly enough, I know your show is about health and fitness, but there certainly is a fitness aspect to this. I was diagnosed at 34, and I started, like I said, looking back at the early part of my life, and there were times sporadically when I kind of seemed to have it together more than other times. So I actually pulled out my college transcripts, and I started looking at the semesters where my grades were much better and I kind of had a better hold on things. And I realized that it really coincided with times that I was exercising more. And what happened was, aside from going to the gym and working out, I realized that the semesters when I was kind of had everything together, I was running regularly, and I didn't even think of it as exercise. I needed to get out, clear my head, and move. And that led me to embrace running as one of the things that I do to cope with my ADHD. And later on, I learned there is a lot of significant research on issues involving exercise and improved brain function. So it's not only good for your body, but it's good for your mind as well.
Okay, well, let's first start off with what exactly is ADHD for people that don't know?
ADHD is a neurobiological condition. And again, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a doctor, so I'm going to give you a disclaimer up front. This is grossly oversimplified. Okay? Okay, it's a neurobiological condition that affects the prefrontal cortex of your brain, and that's the part of your brain that deals with executive functioning. Okay, and that is the almost like the symphony conductor or the office manager in your brain, the part of your brain that deals with management, self-regulation, impulse control, time perception, prioritization, all of those executive functioning tasks. And, you know, a lot of us are challenged with time. A lot of us are challenged with controlling our impulses. And when it comes to behavior, especially with kids and even adults with this disability, what happens is they know right from wrong. They know they're not supposed to steal, for instance. But the kid next to me in school had a new iPhone. I couldn't stop myself from taking it. It doesn't mean it's okay to do that. But what we try and do is understand where that behavior comes from, so that we can put into place some behavioral interventions to prevent it from happening tomorrow.
Okay.
And that's really, you know, where this comes from. And impulse control is really, I would say, the behavioral culprit in all of the ADHD symptoms.
Okay. Now, how is it diagnosed?
It's diagnosed several ways. There are a number of rating scales that are questionnaires and tests that psychologists will use. There is also, I'm told, that the best way to diagnose a disorder like this is through a detailed clinical history that's taken by a psychiatrist.
Okay.
For educational purposes, it's more important to understand not just ADHD, but if I need to get services for a kid in school, for instance, that psychological testing is important because it doesn't just tell me what the diagnosis is, it tells me how it impacts that kid. For instance, if a kid has a slow processing speed, that tells me I need to seek extra time for them with their assignments and with their tests. And so that really can be a blueprint for the services and support that I need to get for that kid in school in an educational setting.
Right. Now, I also read that the brain scans in children can also show that the brain regions are smaller than they are in children than the general population.
I don't know if it's as much that it's smaller, but the brain scans and functional MRIs do show that different parts of the brain will react differently. For instance, my need to move, part of my running, is I've learned about myself that I'm what's called a kinesthetic processor. I need to move in order to process information. Those are the people that are pacing all the time. The kids in class that can't sit still, that are tapping their pencil.
The hyperactivity?
The bodies need movement in order for their brain to work. And in those functional MRIs or SPECT scans, you can actually see if you try to get a kid like that to sit still, parts of their brain will actually shut down. The problem with an MR, functional MRI or SPECT scan, is that it's a very expensive tool and they can't really functionally use it to diagnose ADHD. So they still use the rating scales and the clinical interviews and all of that, a lot of observation by parents and teachers and that type of thing.
Okay, now is it common to misdiagnose the disorder?
It can be. What happens is there are two things that go on. There is a horrible stigma that goes along with mental health disorders in this country. And as much as parents try to protect their children from those stigmas, many parents unwittingly will feed into them by being embarrassed, for instance, to take their child to a psychiatrist. And so what happens is if the school is reporting that the kid is either hyperactive or can't hold their attention, the parents will bring the kid to the primary care physician, pediatrician, who will say, oh, you know, maybe we can give Ritalin for that. But there are other disabilities that mimic the symptoms of ADHD. For instance, there's a learning disability called phonemic awareness, where kids cannot equate the phonetic sounds with the printed word. And so what happens is a lot of these kids in class, because they can't make that connection, will shut down and kind of start to not pay attention. And that can look like ADHD, but it's not. Also, another thing that happens is that ADHD is often, in like 70% of the cases, present with a co-occurring disability or a learning disability or another mental health disorder. And sometimes the treating of the ADHD can make the other thing worse. That happens. We see that a lot with bipolarity and ADHD. If you exercise too much or take stimulant medication, that can make the bipolarity worse because it kind of accelerates their manic cycle. But it's very effective for the ADHD. So it gets complicated.
Now, I also read that it's described as having a Ferrari engine for a brain with bicycle brakes.
Bicycle brakes, yes.
Is that true?
It is. It's funny that you say that, too, because I was being interviewed for an article in the New York Times Magazine a bunch of years ago, and we were in my office, and it was very quiet, and the reporter was asking me what it's like to have ADHD, and what I was saying to her was, we're having a very intelligent, calm conversation right now, but what you don't see is that there's an amusement park going on in my head at this moment, and the reporter really didn't understand that, and it's very hard, because that also, that aspect, the Ferrari brain with the bicycle brakes, explains a lot, because there's so much going on. There's also, in addition to physical hyperactivity that you can see from the outside, there's also a lot of cognitive hyperactivity. That's the Ferrari brain going, you know, 100 miles an hour. And it's hugely different. There's a huge disconnect from the slow reality of life. And that's why people with ADHD are challenged when it comes to time, because there's a big disconnect from what's going on in our heads to how the world works. And so it's not just about, people will say people with ADHD have terrible time management. That's really not a good way to look at it, because first of all, if you have an executive functioning impairment, you can't manage anything. Time is particularly difficult for people with ADHD because of that disconnect, because things are working so rapidly inside and it's so different. And I run into an issue in my criminal practice, because the drug of choice for teens with ADHD is marijuana, which further distorts that time perception, and it actually makes things much worse.
Really? Now, what are the other cognitive symptoms? Forgetfulness, I think. There was one I read.
Well, it's not so much forgetfulness as it is short-term memory problem. There's two types of memory. If you think about your computer, okay, your computer has two types of memory. One is the storage. You can store, you know, however many gigabytes of information long term.
Okay.
And people with ADHD typically have very good long term memory. Short term memory is like the RAM. How many programs can operate at one time? That is where we have a significant impairment. If you think about it like this, New York City is the center of commerce and culture and everything else. People from all over the world are coming to New York, okay, for all of these, for the center of culture. But instead of a number of international airports, we only had one poorly run landing strip, okay? Now, all these planes are flying in from all over the world because everybody wants to be here, but there's no place to land. So what happens in an airport is those planes, they get put in holding patterns. So all these things are whizzing around in our heads with no place to land. But if one of those planes had a bomb on it, it would be an emergency, so they would get instant clearance to land. And that's why people with ADHD often gravitate towards crisis situations, or even many of us manufacture crisis situations, because it's a means of forced prioritization. It's a way of getting that plane on the ground. It's a way of compensating for something that's disconnected inside. And, you know, it can be dangerous because we often will gravitate towards high stimulation activity, which can mean drugs and alcohol. It can mean gambling addiction. It can mean sexual addiction. It can be the adrenaline junkies that are out there jumping out of airplanes. And sometimes there are consequences with high stim activity. For instance, for a teenage girl with ADHD, is 6 to 7 times more likely to have an unplanned teen pregnancy. It's that quest for high stim activity along with poor social choices, regardless of consequences, that really establishes the problem.
Okay. Interesting. Now, it also affects the mood, right? Anger, anxiety?
Yes, it can. First of all, there's a lot of anxiety that goes along with ADHD, yet people with ADHD can also have an anxiety disorder. That's something a little different. But there's a lot of anxiety with, and people from the outside have difficulty seeing this, Shani. What happens is this disability so permeates these kids' sense of self-esteem. And I went through that. And when I see the frustration in their faces, I understand where they're coming from. Because as a kid, I always was angry because I felt as if there was so much more going on behind my eyes than I was getting credit for, because I couldn't do the homework, or I would lose the assignment, or something like that. But I knew I was intelligent and I had something to offer. And we also have a very low frustration tolerance. So if we're not doing well or about something, or we are not getting it, we shut down. And teachers will see that a lot in the classroom.
Wow. Now, does the symptoms of the disorder fall along like a pretty much like a spectrum from mild to severe?
Yes, it does. Okay. What happens is anyone can have executive functioning impairment, okay?
Okay.
Difficulties with your executive functioning process. Now, that can raise, if it's severe enough, it can rise to the level of diagnosable ADHD. And then within ADHD, there's a spectrum. Some people are much more severe than others. It's really a matter of the level of impairment. For instance, when I get interviewed on talk shows like this, I'm often asked, you know, aren't we all a little ADHD and our society is like a short attention span society? We're on Twitter, 140 characters or whatever. And
right.
That's true. We are all suffering from a shorter attention span society. But the difference is the level of impairment and the chronic nature of the disability. For instance, there's a huge difference between someone who has a chemical imbalance in their brain and is clinically depressed and needs to be medicated for that versus sadness that we all may experience at different times in our lives. That can be situational. That can be depending on what's going on. But clinical depression is far more severe and more chronic in nature.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. What do you suggest to parents with children of this disorder?
Well, there are a number of legal issues that arise when parents are afraid to have their kids diagnosed. For instance, in the area that I specialize in, school discipline, at my firm, the kids who have a disability that's diagnosed and the school is providing services and support for them, if they get into discipline trouble, they have added layers of protection under the law because of their disability. For instance, if they get suspended for a certain time frame, if it's more than 10 days, for instance, under the law, they're entitled to a superintendent's hearing to determine whether or not they did what they're accused of. But if they did and they are disabled, there's a special meeting that takes place that's called a manifestation determination. And what we do is we sit together, the educators, the parents, the attorney, and we try to determine whether or not the conduct was a manifestation of that kid's disability. And if that is the case, then what happens is, barring some exceptions like drugs, weapons, or if somebody's seriously injured, the kid can't be disciplined because of their disability, because it means really that the school should have picked this up and put some type of intervention plan into place. So they're entitled to these layers of protection. Now, if you don't have a diagnosis, but you've always suspected that something is up, I certainly encourage parents to check it out and have your child evaluated by the school district as soon as possible. But if you find yourself in a situation where your child is being disciplined and you never spoke up but you think there's something there, you have the right to stop the proceeding and request an immediate expedited evaluation of your child, and that could potentially kick in that process, that manifestation process I talked about. And it's very, very important.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. Now, what about an adult that hasn't had treatment as a child?
Okay. Well, you're not in a school situation, but there are a lot of adults with ADHD, and it's not limited to ADHD. There are a number of other disorders, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, Asperger syndrome, for instance, where you will see antisocial behavior or difficulties with social interaction that will make someone come into contact with the criminal or juvenile justice system. And if you are not diagnosed, but you suspect something is going on, you could seek a diagnosis. There is a system in the country now that is growing in momentum. There's a mental health court system that where you're evaluated for whatever disorders there are, and they will kind of, if you enter treatment and continue with treatment, your charges will be significantly either reduced or in many cases dismissed, kind of like the drug treatment court model.
Okay, well, that's good. But what about somebody that just doesn't have treatment, that didn't get into any kind of criminal law, you know, anything with the law, but they pretty much just are running around without treatment? How do they act?
Well, what I would suggest is, if you're out there and one of your listeners is out there and say, well, you know, I have problems with timing, I have problems with social relationships or impulse control, I think definitely you should investigate ADHD, read about it. There are a number of resources. CHAD, for instance, Children and Adults with ADHD, that's CHADD.org, is a huge nonprofit that provides support to the ADHD community. And they also manage a national resource center that's funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The website for that is help4ADHD.org. And the NRC, the National Resource Center, has all free information about ADHD that's in the public domain. Do some research, learn about it, and seek a psychologist or a psychiatrist to see if you have ADHD or maybe you have some other learning disability. Get some help. Educate yourself. That's really the most important thing.
That's good. That's good advice. Okay, now you mentioned relationships. Now, how does the ADHD affect relationships?
Oh, my goodness, in so many ways. I speak all over the country, and one of the things I say, especially when I'm speaking to an adult audience, is that I have ADHD, but my wife really suffers from ADHD because she unfortunately married me, and she's stuck with this. So my behavior impacts those around me, and that's one of the problems with people with ADHD, is that in part of being unable to regulate your own behavior effectively is that we're very poor self-observers. I always say that I never realized what a terrible driver I was until I got married and my wife told me. And so what happens is that, you know, it impacts someone else. And, you know, educating your spouse or respective other about your disability is really helpful because it helps in terms of the understanding that there is there's a disability here and they're not acting this way because they don't care about me or about our relationship. But, you know, there are practical concerns. I understand where this behavior comes from, but we still have to get things done. And it becomes difficult. The one piece of advice that I would give would be to never use your disability as an excuse for your behavior. You have to own the behavior, but help the other person understand where it's coming from and really show them that you're trying to do something about it. It's funny that when I was first diagnosed, my wife's response was, oh no, is this going to be the new thing you're going to be talking about? And no, you know, we have to learn about this. And I got this book that was written by the guy who made that quote that you said about the Ferrari brain, Ned Halliwell, the very famous book called Driven to Distraction that I highly recommend to people. And having my wife read that book after I did, she really thought the book was written about me. And it kind of helped us both see that it's not just me. There are other people out there that have these issues. And seeing the difference in me medicated versus unmedicated was huge for our relationship. Because when I am taking my medication, when I am running regularly, I am able to function in a way that is much healthier for our relationship. So.
Okay, like give me an example, like the difference with you not taking medication in the relationship and then opposed to taking it.
Okay, I am one of those people with ADHD, probably aside from impulse control, which can drive my wife crazy. I am hugely time challenged. To the extent that when we get places, my wife introduces me to people as her late husband because I am just always late for everything. And you don't realize how unfair it is to the other person in the relationship. If you're supposed to meet someone somewhere and you're an hour late because you got stuck into your own vortex, that's also something that's classic about ADHD is one of the misconceptions is that it's difficult or impossible for someone with ADHD to pay attention. And that's wrong. We either can't pay attention or we have absolute hyperfocus. There's no regulation of attention. That's a more realistic way to look at it. Parents will often say to me, the teachers are telling me my kid can't pay attention, and I don't believe it because he could play video games for 10 hours.
Yeah.
There is, there's no middle of the road. It's either no attention or you're all in. When you're telling that kid to shut the video game and he's ignoring you, not ignoring you because he's acting out, you don't exist in his world at that moment. Because he is so hyper-focused on what he's doing. And that understanding that sometimes can help.
Interesting. Okay, so you suggest somebody that's in a relationship with somebody that has ADHD to read that book. What is the name of the book again?
Driven to Distraction.
Prison to Distraction.
Written by Hallowell and Rady.
Very good. Okay, now, also, here's another question. Is there certain foods to avoid or consume that will help or even hinder the symptoms?
Well, that's a big debate because, by and large, parents are concerned about medicating their children. The medication is probably the most effective thing to do, but but it's a personal choice. I have not seen any kind of clinical data that shows that there's some ADHD diets. I have seen some studies that show that omega-3 fatty acids are very effective in helping with attention. Probably not as much as medication, but if you were going to do it. I also have am concerned that at times there are people that will say, well, you know, we stopped my son or daughter from eating sugar and that made the difference and they can focus better. It's very possible that there's a food allergy, so you just don't know. The one thing that's been clinically proven in a number of scientific studies is exercise. And there's an excellent book that was written by one of the authors of Driven to Distraction, John Ratey, R-A-T-E-Y, called Spark. And it's an excellent book about the correlation between exercise and brain function. And it's not just ADHD. A lot of it is because he's a famous ADHD writer and psychiatrist, but a lot of it has to do with Alzheimer's, clinical depression, anxiety, and, you know, studies that were done with mice, other animals, double-blind studies with humans, et cetera. It's a fascinating book.
Okay. So now, in your opinion, which works better, medicine or behavioral therapy?
My opinion is that you have to really look at a multimodal approach. I think that medication, first of all, there's no cure for ADHD. Medication can work, I would say, probably 80 to 85% of the time, but it's not a cure. It helps manage symptoms. And if you think about it this way, it is a positive tool that can help you make positive changes in your life, but you still have to make those changes. The running along with the medication help a lot. Working with an ADHD coach, for instance, or seeing a therapist, getting educational supports, all in conjunction with the medication, if you really do it as a multimodal approach, that will be the most effective.
Now, you've ran a couple of marathons now.
I've finished 9 marathons.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. because I embraced running around the time of my diagnosis, it became super addictive to me, especially when I saw how much functional improvement there was with me in terms of my organization and kind of getting through anxiety, et cetera. And so I really started getting addicted to running, and I ran the New York City Marathon in 2002. I started running a marathon every year, and then actually what happened was, and I would encourage your readers, I started noticing that if I was going to use my running to kind of help get the word out or educate the public about ADHD or various disabilities and also maybe raise money for some children's causes, it was around the time that the whole concept of crowdfunding was coming around, and that is really kind of by word of mouth, having people support an event that you're doing by making donations. And it really helps two ways. It raises awareness, and it helps raise funding. And I will tell you, I know that you are someone who works out and participates in a lot of fitness events. There is no better way to add meaning to your training than to do it for a cause. And also to involve your community in what you're doing. I was the executive director for an organization, a nonprofit that provided specialized ADHD coaches for college students around the country. And I started this thing called Team Edge. And whenever I ran a marathon, I would get the coaches involved and I would kind of reach out to my community and say, how'd you like to run the Chicago Marathon without ever leaving your house? join me, support the cause. It's a great way to kind of tell your story, share your story, get the word out, and support these events.
Yeah, and it also holds you accountable, and you feel like a sense of completeness.
And you feel like you're not alone when you're doing it. Exactly.
Yeah.
I ran the 2009 New York City Marathon on a team of 125 runners. We were running for Autism Speaks. And that one day, the 125 of us raised $485,000 for Autism Speaks.
Wow. That's amazing.
It really was. It shows you the power of mobilizing your community.
Yeah, and it's giving back also. Yeah. Now, you know, I hear so many different opinions and research on ADHD since I've been reading about it. Now, what causes it?
Well, from what I understand, it is hugely genetic. And it is really, another way to look at it is when you're in middle school, everybody in science class learns that when you put your hand on the hot stove, a signal goes through your hand up to your brain and says, it's hot, move your hand. Okay? We're all kind of familiar with that type of model. And when you think about the brain, if you think about that, you kind of almost picture when you plug a light into the wall, the electricity goes up the wire and the light goes on. That's not the way it works in the human body. It's not one long continuous wire. It's a series of disconnected wires. And those disconnections are bridged by neurotransmitters. And those neurotransmitters, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin are the three main ones. If they are not produced, absorbed, or the receptors, there's a problem with it, there will be a break in those signals. And usually what happens is that the norepinephrine is adrenaline. And so the constant quest for high stimulation activity really is a way to kind of flood yourself with adrenaline constantly. And a lot of times that gets people into trouble.
I could see. So the meds that you take for the disorder pretty much stimulate, I would assume.
Dopamine, yes. They stimulate dopamine.
Okay.
It's also the pleasure center of the brain.
Okay, so then, so it stimulates the brain. And then it also stimulates the attention and the focus then, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And the working out actually affects the brain in a very similar way that stimulant medications do. And, you know, a lot of times I'm speaking at a parent meeting or at a conference, parents will come up to me and say, you know, we're nervous about medicating our child. You know, we're looking at some herbal supplements. And people have to be careful because those herbal supplements, even though you can get them over the counter, are drugs. They can interact, and if there's no doctor involved, that can be difficult. And if you just decide that you're not ready for medication or you don't want to medicate your child or yourself, then do something like exercise. Why wouldn't you? You know what I mean? It's good for your body. It's good for your mind. I say to my wife all the time, if I'm going to be addicted to something, being addicted to running is not that bad.
Yeah, I agree. So. I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Now, and since we're discussing the meds, what meds are used to treat this disorder?
Okay. Now, this is something that I take stimulant medication. Okay.
Okay.
And what people have to know is there's a huge problem, and there are a lot of articles that are written about medication diversion, where at school kids will share their stimulant medication with other kids who are not diagnosed. And what parents have to understand and what students have to understand is that ADHD medication, the stimulant medication anyway, is a Schedule II controlled substance, okay? And the law does not require that any money change hands for it to be considered the sale of a controlled substance, which is a felony in every state. And so it's important that you understand and your children understand that they are taking controlled substance, and they have to safeguard their medication. They should never share their information, their medication. They are subject to criminal prosecution. They're subject to administrative sanctions, like being expelled from school or disciplined at school. And they also feed into the myth that this medication is somehow getting these kids high. You know, a lot of my clients will say to me, if this stuff is supposed to be so addicting, why do I keep forgetting to take it? And it's the biggest problem with kids that take medication is that they're not taking it when they're supposed to, or they forget to take it, or they forget to take their second dose, which is why long-acting versions of the stimulant medication could be much more effective. You only have to take it once instead of three times a day, for instance.
Interesting. Now, how effective are the meds? Can one also become resistant to the meds?
That I don't know. I know this. I'm told that there are times in our lives where our bodies will change. Puberty is a big time, and sometimes the medication's effect on our bodies will be different if we go through a major change like this. There are a lot of doctors who have told me that younger kids will respond better to Ritalin, which is a traditional drug stimulant that's given for ADHD. But after puberty, that may change, and another medication might be more effective. It's important that the most crucial thing, whether you're an adult or you have a child with ADHD, if they're taking medication, I always recommend to keep a medication diary. How is the medication affecting you? What differences are you seeing in behavior? Are they more irritable? Are they eating more or less? Are they sleeping enough? That information is crucial to get to the doctor, because most of the medication information really involves tinkering with the right dosage, the right medication, sometimes a smaller combination of two medications, and that takes time for the doctor to hone in on.
Now, is the disorder progressive as you get older?
I don't necessarily say it's progressive. I think what happens is, if it's untreated, your consequences socially can be much more drastic. As you're going from job to job, or potentially going to jail is a lot more serious than a timeout at school, for instance. I don't know if there's a correlation between, like, for instance, Alzheimer's in a senior citizen and ADHD. That's really a question a doctor would probably have to answer.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, let me ask you this on a personal note. Now, through the years, you've been a dedicated voice and a practicing attorney in the courtroom for people who have ADHD, which is amazing. Now, can you give us, like, an example of a memorable case?
Sure. One of the first cases, actually, that kind of was a wake-up call to me, that really got me involved in opening my practice, not just from criminal work, but to really dive into education law. I was called shortly after my diagnosis. It was around a year after I was diagnosed. I got a call from a colleague who was not a criminal attorney and said, "Rob, I need your help. My nephew got arrested at school." And so I said, "Okay, tell me where and I'll go and I'll take care of it." And he said, "Before we hang up, he's got ADHD. I don't know if you know anything about it." I said, "Yes, I have ADHD myself." It's funny because I'm very vocal about my ADHD, because I think that's the only way we're ultimately going to get rid of stigma. And so I go to the school, and it turns out this kid was not an aggressive or hyperactive kid, the typical discipline problem. He was more inattentive, very sensitive kid, and he was being routinely bullied by the gym teacher in the school. And for the last 2 years, he was in a BOCES program. BOCES is the Board of Cooperative Education. They provide supplemental services at school districts. He was going to the BOCES program, and his mother, after school, and his mother was trying to get him into that program full-time. She wanted to get him away from this teacher. Nobody would listen to her. What happened was, one day the bullying was particularly bad, and he was sitting on a front bench by the school waiting for the bus, and hysterical crying, and he reached into his backpack and pulled out a marker and wrote on the bench, "Sometimes I wish this whole place would just blow up." And the assistant principal saw him writing it. It was about 2 weeks after Columbine, and the school went on red alert. They had him arrested. They shut down the school. They brought in bomb-sniffing dogs. I had a discipline hearing, and I had a criminal prosecution going on at the same time. And in the hearing, which is one of the benefits of doing this type of work, is that I can cross-examine all of the witnesses and get all of the reports in the disciplinary hearing that I wouldn't get in the criminal case for 8 months to a year. And so it really is a significant advantage. And the only thing that's advantageous about that situation. And I focused on his ADHD, and I understood his anxiety, his depression,
frustration.
His frustration, exactly. Yeah. And I got a phone call from the school district's attorney the next day. And he said to me, you know, you really seem to key in on that ADHD. What can we do to make this go away? And I said to him, look, it's an easy solution here. This kid goes to this after-school program, and he does really well there, and his mother's been trying to get him into this program full-time, and nobody would listen. If you can get him into this program, I think we could resolve this. And the guy said one word, done. And the school backed off their prosecution of the criminal case. I was able to get that case dismissed. He went into that program, did extremely well. He's now a fireman. And aww, it's funny because when I speak to his mom, she was so happy that we were able to get a good result. However, she still has a lot of bitterness because she was jumping up and down for 2 years to ask for something and nobody would listen because she was just a mom. But it took something terrible to happen in order for people to wake up and see what can we do to resolve this issue. And that's really, that told me a lot. That case told me that I could be doing more for these kids before they get in trouble. And so that's why I really focused my practice in a different way.
Okay, so are you mainly focusing now with children that have ADHD or adults
most
too?
Most of my practice is children and adolescents, I would say. Probably most of it is adolescents, high school, middle school, college age, kids that get into discipline problems at school. And there's also a criminal case, or even if it's just a discipline case. And we also help kids in terms of just there's no discipline problem, but they need special reading support or they need support for their social skills and their social interaction before there's any problem. So, and a lot of times there is a need for the services that they need is not available at the school that they go to, and the law requires the school district to place them privately and pay the tuition. Children are have a right to a free, appropriate public education in the school district they live in, and if the school district can't provide it, they have to place that kid in a private school and pay the tuition. And there's a lot of litigation that goes on that issue.
Is it the funding that they're not providing it, or
funding?
Why aren't they getting the support they need?
Because sometimes it's a question of not have. If you think about it, if you have a school that has 2,000 kids in it, and three of them need a special kind of support, it's not always easy to hire someone just for those three kids. You have to provide education. And sometimes you can't effectively. Some kids need a lot of support. You know, sometimes they need a one-to-one ratio or a four-to-one ratio of students with a teacher. And it's not always the district is not always able to do that. And so, and quite frankly, I find, and this is sad, but it's the kids that are bouncing off the walls causing the behavioral problems, where the school district will not fight as hard because they want to get that kid out of the school. And so they will kind of look to kind of place them somewhere. So it's a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it the teacher's responsibility to recognize this in a child
really? It's not just the teacher. It's actually at the K to 12 level, kindergarten to 12th grade, the law is written. All three laws, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, Section 504, and the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, those all require this component in them called child find. And what that means is that it's the responsibility of the school district to evaluate children or to kind of see if there are problems with children that live within their school district and evaluate them and provide services and support to meet their needs. And it's the school district's burden. The bigger problem is that when you graduate to college, that child find component drops off. And it's now the child's responsibility to self-report their disability and request services. And a lot of kids are reluctant to do that when they're going to college. And that's a big problem.
Sure. I mean, because from doing my research, I realized that ADHD is very common.
It's about 10% of the general population has ADHD, but interestingly enough, I've seen statistics between 50 and 70% of prison populations, depending on the study that I've seen. And what's difficult is that a lot of the criminal work that I do, people with mental health disorders, not just ADHD, there's not only a higher population of them in prisons, but they stay in prison between 5 and 8 times longer than someone without a mental health disorder. So it's a huge burden on the system. And even adolescents that are, that have done something terrible that they should be put in a secure facility, a rape case, a murder case, or something like that, they still are entitled to a free, appropriate public education while they're in that secure facility. And all of the services that their IEP, their individualized education program, gives them are supposed to be maintained in a secure jail setting. And that is not happening in this country. And that's a huge tragedy.
Oh. Now, how is that working now? I mean, are they trying to get a bill passed for that?
Well, what's happening now is there's not any one bill that I can point my finger on, but the federal government is now doing a lot more research into this area as a way to reduce the mentally ill prison population, because the prisons are so overcrowded, and they are actually now looking at school discipline and addressing things in a different way in
before they get to the crime.
Mm. Right, to try to limit what they call the school to prison pipeline.
Right, prevention.
And Shani, another thing I want to mention, because this is a really important issue.
Sure.
That ADHD, learning disabilities, oppositional defiant disorder, autism spectrum disorders, don't discriminate across racial or socioeconomic line. But the problem in this country is that the access to information and to services and to treatment does in fact discriminate very harshly. And so you will find a lot more people from underserved communities with undiagnosed mental health disorders that are in the jail system. And that's a huge problem that needs to be addressed.
Now, what's the most common discipline case with ADHD?
Well, what I can tell you is this. There was a 10-year follow-up study done at Harvard. Okay. And people with ADHD have a 50% higher risk of developing a alcohol or substance abuse problem, substance use disorder. And if your ADHD co-occurs with oppositional defiant disorder, or more importantly, if oppositional defiant disorder morphs into a conduct disorder, and that co-occurs with ADHD, that increased risk, that 50% higher risk, now triples.
Sure.
And so you will see a lot more people. That's one of the biggest ways that people with mental health disorders come into contact with the system, is that they're self-medicating with some type of controlled
drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, exactly.
And it coincides, yeah. Oh, it's terrible. It's really terrible. Well, Robert, listen, we're coming shortly to a close here. Do you have anything that you would like to say to our listeners that you feel of importance?
Yes, I think that if you're a parent, please don't be afraid to, if your child is diagnosed with ADHD, or someone in the family is diagnosed with ADHD, probably the worst thing that you can do is let it be the thing that we don't talk about in the house. Silence breeds shame, okay? And I can tell you from someone who always felt when they were growing up that they were not as smart or slower, or that there was something wrong with me and I didn't know what it was, that shame can really fester. And what is a more practical problem is, as I was saying before, when these kids graduate from high school and go to college, okay, the reason why a lot of them don't report their disability and ask for services when they go to college is because, and I've spoken to a number of adolescents with ADHD when I was running the Edge Foundation, when they go off to college, they don't want to talk about their disability. ADHD or bipolar disorder or autism is something that my parents told me I had, and it made me feel broken. And when I go away to college, I don't want to be disabled. I just want to fit in with everybody else. I just want to be like everybody else. And so often they will not ask for services. They'll not talk about their ADHD. They will not take their medication according to a medication plan that has worked when they were at home and they had a lot of structure around them. And that's where we see a lot of these kids crash and burn. So talk about the disability. Talk to your kids. It's not something to apologize for. It's not something to be embarrassed of. It doesn't make us better or worse. We're just different. And like any community, it's all about educating the public about us and learning to accept us for who we are.
Now, where can someone find support, or what organizations are there if somebody wants to raise awareness or donate or help or anything?
Sure. There are a number of organizations. Probably the biggest one is the one I mentioned earlier. CHADD is Children and Adults with ADHD. It's CHADD.org. There's another organization for adults with ADHD called ADDA, the Attention Deficit Disorder Association. That is ADD.org. Also, NAMI is the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI.org. There's also another resource, another organization I belong to called the Council of Parents, Advocates, and Attorneys, COPA, C-O-P-A-A at COPAA.org. That has a huge source of information for parents. It's got a network of disability and education attorneys around the country. I am of counsel to the law firm of Barger and Gaines in Irvington, New York. And if anyone has any questions for me, reach me at Robert at Barger Gaines, GAINES.com.
Okay, very good. You know, I want to thank you, Robert, for coming here today. I mean, and enlightening us on this, oh my gosh, it's extremely important disorder. I mean, not only the knowledge and the symptoms of the disorder, but the awareness and the effects of it, and also the manageability and the coping skills. I mean, it's kind of good to know that the amount of support there is out there, and yourself as a prime example and role model for ADHD. I mean, you represent someone who's challenged by this disorder and how you fight it and became such an extremely successful spokesman, you know, along with a practicing attorney, you know, how you dedicate your time and, you know, all your accomplishments. I mean, I'm very impressed, as I'm sure many are, you know. I mean, you're
also
doing, pardon?
I was just going to say, it's also important for parents to know that as difficult as things can be, there's an enormous amount of comfort knowing you're not alone. And with all of these support organizations out there, you really are not alone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely good information, and at least now some of the listeners that are out there, you know, at least they're able to know that there's support and know that, you know, they can lead a normal life with the proper medication and, you know, the behavioral therapy and all the other books and stuff that's out there. Yeah. I hope that you come back in the near future, Robert, with more updates in your writings and, you know, your books and stuff. What is it, the books that you've written and the writings?
I haven't written any books, but I have written for a number of disability magazines. I've written a number of articles on legal aspects, adult coping skills, advocacy issues for advocating for your children. If anyone's interested in a particular topic, you can email me, and I'd be happy to get you copies of what I've written. And I also want to thank you, Shaney, for giving me the forum to provide this information to your listeners, because getting this information out is really important, and you're very helpful in doing that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I hope that you come back and keep us posted on everything. Yeah, I mean, this is really good stuff. Robert, thank you so much. And once again, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in with us. And if you'd like to drop me an email about anything about the show or any show ideas, my email is shaneyrubin14@gmail.com. Once again, I am your host, Shaney Rubin. And until next week, we will see you then. Thank you. Robert, thank you so much. You're welcome.